She can imagine the guard smiling to himself, imagining his boss screwing her brains out. Maybe he thought he would get the leftovers. She felt Dykes growing weaker. She clamped her legs like a vice around him. The garrote was cutting into his neck, so fiercely was she pulling on it. He started gurgling.
Yes! Yes!
She screamed, covering the sounds he was making. And then she started to turn his head slowly to the side, even as she kept increasing the pressure on his neck.
Give it to me! Give it all to me!
He was facing her now. His eyes were bulging, and blood filled from the hemorrhaging her stranglehold was causing. Foam was pouring out of his mouth. He exerted his last bit of strength to try to throw her off. That did topple them off the bed, but Reel's grip never failed. She swung her right leg up and placed her foot against the top of his head. She whispered,
"Goodbye, Leon, and tell De Fuhrer to kiss my ass when you see him in hell."
She screamed,
"Yes, you son of a bitch!"
She jerked his neck to the right with her hands at the same time she slammed his head to the left with her foot. Dyke's neck snapped cleanly. As he grew limp, she relaxed her legs around his torso, pushed away from him, and then gripped his lifeless hand and took off his watch. She rose from the floor breathless. With her hands still bound, she picked up his gun, strode to the door, checked the time on the watch, counted to five, and then fired the weapon three quick times into the ceiling. And then all hell truly broke loose. Chapter 46. The extra-long semi that had passed the van earlier had doubled back and parked. From the trailer had emerged three black SUVs. There were eight men in each vehicle. Each man was armored, had night vision optics, and was loaded with weaponry. They headed toward the front of the neo-Nazi complex. From the rear came 10 more men who had parked their motorcycles a quarter mile away and made the last part of the trek on foot. They were armored, had night optics too, and were also loaded for bear, or at least for neo-Nazis. Roby was leading this group. They crossed a rise and then swiftly made their way down to it. 300 feet away was the cluster of buildings with a fence around it. Roby checked his watch and waited 5 minutes. Then he signaled his men forward. 100 feet away, they stopped. Their optics revealed clear green images of the perimeter patrol. There were only three of them. Roby's group moved forward again to within 50 feet. Rifles were aimed and red dots appeared on each of the chests of the perimeter uniforms. Roby checked his watch again. He watched the second hand make its way around the clock face. Then the three shots rang out, and Roby started to run. Instantly, three rifles fired and the three perimeter men dropped where they stood. They weren't dead, merely tranquilized. Roby and his team didn't want to deprive the men of a long prison sentence. Roby was over the fence in a few seconds, followed by five of his men. They dropped down inside the compound and immediately received fire. They took cover and returned it, this time with live rounds. Meanwhile, in the front, the electric-powered SUVs had moved so silently with lights out that they were nearly at the gate before the guards there could react. By then, it was too late. The gates crashed inward and the SUVs hurtled into the inner yard. The men sprang out of the vehicles and raced straight toward the main building. The two guards there were quickly surrounded and trussed up. Reel had shot the guard in the hall who had been eavesdropping on her and Dyke's lovemaking. She hurried on and shot another neo-Nazi who appeared in front of her with his weapon out. A moment later, she was slammed against the wall and the gun fell from her bound hands. A foot kicked it away. She recovered her balance and stared up into the face of the huge Albert, dressed in his black SS uniform. He smiled down at her, still in her underwear, as he slid his tongue along his mouth.
"I'm gonna have some fun with you, sweet thing."
Reel struck so fast, Albert had no time to react. She slammed her foot into his crotch, doubling him over, and then whipsawed around and struck him in the right kidney with her elbow. He screamed in fury, but only for a second.
Using the wall opposite as both a launch point and for leverage, she pushed off and slammed both feet into his buttocks. Bent over as he was, Albert crashed head first into the wall opposite. The top of his skull hit first, driving his neck upward to an impossible degree, and his head back so far that his neck broke. Dead Albert dropped to his knees. Real was already racing onward, and never saw him slump to the concrete floor. She heard a scream to her left and raced down the hall. One man stumbled out of a doorway, a knife sticking out his chest. He slumped to the floor, dead, his cap falling off his head on the way down. Laura appeared in the doorway, saw Real, and said,
"They separated me from Julie. I think she's down this way. Hurry."
The two women raced down the hall and toward the room at the end. There was a crashing of glass, screams, and then gunshots. Real shouted,
"That's Julie!"
She and Laura sprinted forward.
"Julie!"
screamed Real. The door was bolted, but she shot the lock off and burst into the room and stopped. Two men lay on the floor, their bodies covered by shattered glass. Julie was flattened against one wall. There was movement at the window. Real pointed her gun that way and then caught a breath. Roby clambered through the empty window and dropped to the floor. He put his pistol back into his holster and looked at Julie. "Are you hurt?" She shook her head and stepped toward Roby, her feet crunching over the glass that littered the floor. Roby put his arm around her and then looked down at the men. "I think they had orders to kill Julie in the event of an attack."
"So you shot them through the window?"
deduced Real. "So I shot them through the window," confirmed Roby. His walkie-talkie squawked, and he spoke into it and then listened. "We're secure. No casualties on our side. Most of the assholes just gave up."
"Well, not the one who really counted,"
said Real. "No prison for Mr. Dykes?" said Roby.
"Not in this life. Let's open his next one, for all eternity."
Roby pulled his knife and severed the bindings on Real's hands. He took off his jacket and draped it around her. Julie looked from Real to Laura.
"Is she your daughter?"
Real rubbed her wrists and shook her head slowly.
"I'd like you to meet FBI Special Agent Leslie Shepard, Julie."
Shepard nodded at Julie and gave her a shy smile.
"I just look really young for my age."
Roby said, "The FBI doesn't like people being kidnapped. They provided all the ground assets we needed." Julie said,
"FBI? So Super Special Agent Vance?"
"She cares about you a great deal, Julie. She's the reason we were able to put this all-out effort together." Real looked at Roby.
"Any problems finding us?"
He shook his head.
"How did you track them?"
asked Julie.
"I heard Dykes and his men talking about the steps they'd taken to make sure you couldn't do that."
"Our friends at National Geospatial," answered Roby. "They sort of run the spy satellite network."
"The DD of the CIA spoke with her counterpart at Geospatial, and they dialed up several satellites. They tracked us all the way to our rendezvous with Dykes' men. They placed an electronic marker on us at that point. There was no way to lose us. They simply followed using multiple eyes up in the sky. The actual technology has a specific name, but it's classified. I'm just glad it worked."
"Very hard to lose a bunch of satellites," said Roby. "They fed us the location on the ground. We passed by the van carrying Real and Shepard. We were on motorcycles and in a semi. We surrounded the place and waited for the signal."
"Signal?"
asked Julie. "Gun fired three times in a row by Jessica," said Roby.
"But how did you know she'd be able to get a gun?"
Roby smiled. "That's where the element of trust comes in."
"I did what I needed to do,"
said Real.
"And then fired the gun."
"And that's when we came charging in," said Roby.
"And saved me again,"
finished Julie. Real went over to her and knelt down.
"You wouldn't have needed saving, but for me, I was the reason you were taken.
I told them a false story about you, that you were still in Witsec. I wanted him to be surprised when he found out what you really could do."
"He was surprised."
"And I was never really afraid."
"Why not?"
asked Real.
"I knew you'd come and save me."
"How could you be so sure?"
Now Julie smiled.
That's where the element of trust comes in.
Chapter 47.
Nicole Vance sipped a mug of hot coffee as her team processed the scene. She glanced over at Roby and Real and Agent Leslie Shepard, who were sitting in chairs inside one of the rooms of the neo-Nazi facility. Sitting between Roby and Real was Julie, huddled in a blanket and drinking hot chocolate. Vance walked over to them and said,
"We've had our eyes on this group for a while. Domestic terrorism in addition to just being scumbags. They were smart how they went about it. Never left any evidence or witnesses behind. They had their hands in lots of things, though, we believe, including human trafficking and arms dealing."
"Nice people, just like the assholes they were emulating," said Roby.
"And with so many of them in custody, it might lead us to other places and more arrests."
"I wish you nothing but the best on that." She glanced at Julie.
"You need anything else, Julie?"
She shook her head.
"I'm just glad Jerome is okay."
"He was lucky. His skull is apparently a lot harder than they thought. He's still in the hospital, but the docs have assured me he's going to be okay. We'll get you home on a pair of Bureau wings as soon as we can."
"I've got a lot of homework to catch up on,"
admitted Julie. Vance glanced at Roby.
"How jaded youth becomes."
Julie shot a glance at Shepard and then looked over at Real.
"So where is your Real daughter?"
Real looked down at her hands. She said quietly,
"I don't know. I had to give her up for adoption a long time ago."
"Why?"
Julie wanted to know.
"Because I was really just a kid myself, and I had no job, and then the job that was offered to me didn't provide for a baby in tow."
"Right,"
said Julie, both looking and sounding disappointed. Real got to her feet and turned to Shepard.
"Leslie, I owe you more than I can ever repay."
Shepard took Real's offered hand and shook it.
"Are you kidding? My honor."
Real turned to Vance.
"Can I ask you a favor?" "How can I say no?"
said Vance.
"Can I take a couple of photos?"
"Of what?"
"I'll show you."
The two women left. Roby turned to Julie. "You sure you're okay? They didn't, you know, do anything to you."
"Other than smacking me around, the creeps left me alone. But that wouldn't have lasted. The head guy was a psycho."
She drew closer to Roby.
"Did you know that Jessica didn't know where her daughter was?"
"No, I just recently found out she had a daughter. She'd never talked about it before."
"Do you think she regrets it? I mean, giving up her kid?"
"I don't know. I guess most mothers regret it, don't they?" Julie shrugged and looked somber.
"Some don't have a choice, like my mom, but she always wanted me back."
She thought for a few seconds.
"I think Jessica regrets it."
"I think you're right." Roby put an arm around her shoulders. "And I know Jerome will be glad to get you back."
"Are you going to make this, like, a habit?"
"What?"
"Saving me."
She was joking, but Roby frowned. "I hope I never have to again, Julie, considering it was our screw-up that got you involved in the first place."
"We got out okay."
"No one can count on that to keep happening." He was about to say something else when a woman appeared in the doorway. Roby looked at her in surprise. It was Dee Dee Amanda Marks. She smiled and came forward.
"You must be Julie. I've heard quite a bit about you from a friend of yours."
"Jessica?"
asked Julie. Marks nodded.
"I've been told that everything turned out all right."
"It did," said Roby. "And thanks for the assist."
"I almost never get an opportunity to give back. It actually felt good."
Real came back into the room, trailed by Vance. Real looked relieved about something. Vance actually looked pleased. Real shook her hand.
"Thanks. This means a lot. I truly hope it works out for you." "Oh, I think it'll work out just fine now."
She looked over and saw Marks.
"I'd like to finish this now, ma'am, if that's okay."
"With my blessing, Agent Real, with my blessing."
Julie glanced sharply at Roby.
"What are they talking about?"
"I'm not sure," admitted Roby. Real called out to him.
"Hey, Roby, you want to be in on the end of this thing?"
"And what would that be?"
"I'd prefer to show rather than tell."
Julie whispered to him.
"You better go, and you better tell me everything that happens."
Roby rose and headed toward Reel. Where to? He asked.
Not that far away, actually. We can take a car. But I need to make a phone call first and get things set up.
Just one phone call?
One is all it takes, if you call the right person.
Chapter 48. It was raining. Even in here, Earl Fontaine could hear the drops colliding against the roof of the prison. He could hear the wind howling, too. He snuggled more comfortably in his hospital bed. Now that it was over, he knew he could die a happy man. But then again, he might just hang on a little longer. He had a bed, a roof over his head, meds for the pain, 3 squares a day, even if they were in the form of liquid shot into his gut via a tube, and a good-looking personal doctor to look after him. Not a bad life, actually. He glanced over at the bed once occupied by Junior. He smiled. He had no idea how such a moron had been able to kill so many people and elude capture for as long as Junior had. Earl had only had to call his friend, and Big Albert had been put on the case. First to hide the knife in Junior's bed, then it had been up to Earl to get the idiot to pull it out. Well, that had been easy enough. When Junior's fingers had touched the knife, his fate was sealed. Albert had been instructed on exactly what to do. Grab Junior, keep the knife clamped in his hand, pretend to struggle, and then kill the little son of a bitch and kill him good. And if there was one thing Albert was good at, it was killing. Earl wondered if he had been the one designated to kill Sally. He hoped so. She would be dead as dead could be. He sighed contentedly and closed his eyes as the rain continued to pound down. He slept for a while, figuring that a nap before his last round of meds would be good. Earl? A hand grasped his shoulder. Earl, the voice said more urgently. Earl opened his eyes. He had been dreaming about the female doctor. It had been a damn fine dream. She had been naked and tied up, and he was about to... What? He blinked and slowly rolled over on his back to stare up into the face of the same male nurse he'd talked to before. What is it? Time for my meds? He looked at the big clock on the wall. He'd only been asleep an hour. It wasn't time for his medication. The rain was still falling outside, and the wind made the old prison shudder under its assault. Earl grimaced. What did you wake me up for? Ain't time for my meds, boy, not by a long shot. He was upset that his dream had been interrupted. He started to close his eyes once more. The nurse shook him once more. It's not about your meds, Earl. You got a visitor. Well, visitors. Earl blinked more rapidly. Visitors? It's nighttime, boy. Ain't no visitors allowed after dark, you know that. Well, they're here. Who is? The nurse pointed to his left. Them. Earl looked over, and when he saw them, his heart almost stopped. Jessica Reel and Will Roby stood there, their hair slicked down and their clothes dripping from the inclement weather they had just come through. Earl sat up so fast one of his IV lines became tangled in his bedsheets. The nurse disentangled it and stepped back. He looked at the expression on Earl's features, and then at the one on Reel's, and he said quickly, I'll just let you folks visit then. He turned and hurried off. Reel stepped forward, with Roby right behind her. Sally? Said Earl. He attempted a grin, but it failed about halfway to his mouth. What'd you be doing here, girl?
Just coming to say goodbye, Earl.
Hell, you already done that. Not that I ain't glad to see you again. Reel ignored this as she stepped closer.
And I have something to show you, too.
She slipped from her pocket a picture and held it out to him.
I think you'll recognize him, even if he looks a little pale.
Earl put out a shaky hand and took the photo from her. When he gazed down at the picture, he immediately gasped.
Albert, I think, is his name. He's dead, of course, but you should still be able to tell it's him.
How did he die? Said Earl in a croaky voice.
Oh, I guess I forgot to mention that. I killed him. broke his neck. For such a big guy, he went fast, which was good for me. I had other pretend Nazis to deal with.
Gaping, Earl looked up at her, his eyes wide. You done killed him? Him?
I don't think I ever told you what I do now, Earl. On behalf of the American people, I take scum like Albert and make sure they never hurt anyone ever again. Like this bastard.
She pulled another picture from her jacket and dropped it on Earl's belly. He took it with a trembling hand, his face the color of ash.
This is one of your buddies, too, Leon Dykes. I knew him a long time ago. We recently got together, at his insistence. Apparently, he was hanging around the prison and coincidentally saw me when I came to visit you. Talk about a small world.
Earl looked up into her face. Did you kill him, too? Real made a rough oval with her hands and then ripped them apart.
Highly effective move. Death is instant. Before he died, Leon sent his regards and told you he was sorry your plan didn't work.
Earl dropped the photo like it was a snake about to bite him. Ain't know what you talking about.
Sure you do, Earl. Don't back away from the credit for all this now. It really was very clever, and I don't give compliments easily, I can assure you.
You making no sense. Now you got nothing else, I'm going back to sleep.
Well, I think your nap will have to wait.
Why's that? Snapped Earl, his confidence returning. You got nothing, or else you would have done brought the cops with you. What they gonna do to me anyway? Arrest me? Put me in jail? Shit! He laughed until he choked.
No police, no new charges. The old ones will suffice.
So like I said, get your ass gone. I need my rest.
But you're doing great. A lot healthier than you were.
He sat up straighter. What the hell you talking about? I got terminal cancer. I ain't getting better.
Yeah, but there's more to it than that.
She pointed to her right. Earl looked that way and saw the female prison doctor striding toward them.
Dr. Andrews, thank you for coming in tonight,
said Real. Andrews gave a forced smile.
My pleasure. Wouldn't have missed it, actually.
Real said to Earl,
I explained to Dr. Andrews her role in getting you and me back together and also how that led to a very nice visit with your good friend Leon Dykes and his group of merry neo-Nazi freaks. Yes, it was fascinating, Mr. Fontaine,
said Dr. Andrews, who looked like she wanted to pull a gun and fire a round right into Earl's brain. I ain't got no idea what you two gals are jabbering about, said Earl. No idea at all.
Well, let's see if I can make it crystal clear for you. First, Dr. Andrews has some terrific news for you.
Earl looked at Andrews. What news?
While your cancer is still terminal, it's been determined that your condition has stabilized.
What the hell does that mean?
That means that you can leave the hospital ward and this prison. You're being sent back to solitary confinement on death row.
Earl's face collapsed. But they can execute me. Andrew smiled.
Unfortunately, that's true, but you can be cared for there, although I have to say it won't be nearly as pleasant as here, and you will have no human contact with anyone other than the prison personnel.
You can't do that, Earl protested. Well, actually we can, said the voice. The man in the suit walked in with four beefy guards behind him. What the hell is he doing here? Exclaimed Earl. Rhea looked behind her.
The warden of this fine facility and his men are here to take care of your transfer back to death row at the Holman Correctional Facility.
There was a flash of lightning at the barred window followed by a vicious crack of thunder. The warden waved his men forward. Just roll the bed and all right out. The transport vehicle is waiting. You can't do this, sputtered Earl. You can't! Get him out of here, ordered the warden. Now! The guards unhooked Earl's shackles from the wall and rolled his bed with him screaming his head off out of the room. They heard his shouts for another minute before a heavy door clanged shut, and then Earl Fontaine was heard no more. Real turned to the warden, Ann Andrews.
Thank you. No, thank you,
said Andrews.
To think that bastard used me to try and accomplish all these horrific things.
Damn right, said the warden. We might not be able to execute him, but we can make whatever time he has left as unpleasant as legally possible. And we will. He marched off. Andrew said,
When I got your call, I really couldn't believe it. I thought I was helping a father find his daughter. I should have known that Earl Fontaine was a man who didn't care about that.
He took a lot of people in, Doc,
said Real. But never again, said Roby.
Nope, never again,
added Real. After thanking Andrews again for her help, they turned and left the prison. Feel better? Asked Roby, when they climbed into the car after running across the parking lot as the rain continued to pour.
Actually, Roby, I don't feel anything, and maybe that's the best.
Roby put the car in gear, and they left the Alabama prison, and with it, Earl Fontaine, behind forever. Chapter 49 The North Koreans had no facility like the burner box. They didn't have the budget for it. No country spent what the Americans did on defense or internal security. But Chung Cha felt like they made up with effort and dedication what they lacked in funding. She ran through the streets of Pyongyang until she could run no more. And then she kept going. The State Security Department had a generic gymnasium facility where she built up her strength. They had shooting ranges deep underground where she worked on her aim, reaction time, and motor skills in the use of all sorts of firearms and other weapons. There, against only men who were far larger and stronger than she was, she drilled on certain close-quarter combat techniques, some of which she had employed to subdue Lloyd Carson in Romania. Her training wasn't only physical. She could speak fluent English as well as three other languages. But what she really excelled at, in addition to remaining calm under the most extreme circumstances, was martial arts. There had never been a man to beat her, not even several of them. She attributed this to her time at the camp. To survive the camp took Herculean toughness, but that was not enough. To survive the camp and keep your human spirit, your belly fire, was nearly impossible. She had accomplished the impossible. And to survive the camp, one had to think 10 moves ahead. She had become adept at that. The same held true for the martial arts. She not only outfought her opponents, she outthought them as well. Her department had spent much time and money in developing her ability to attack superior numbers and come away victorious. It was a combination of original tactics, superlative fighting skills, and the ability to assess and take risks, often turning a disadvantage into an advantage. She had shown that when confronted with the administrator and the prison guards, she had turned the strengths of her opponents into weaknesses, and she had never stopped moving or fighting. It was as if her mind and her body were a single unit. She returned to her apartment tired but satisfied that her skill level remained undiminished. She was aware that with the upcoming mission, she would be pitted against the best security detail in the world. She knew that the U.S. Secret Service was widely regarded as invincible, all agents willing to die to protect whomever they were guarding. But they had lost protectees in the past, so they weren't infallible. Still, it would probably be her greatest challenge. She ate her rice and drank her tea and listened to country music on the iPod that the Supreme Leader had given her. She looked out the window for the man who had been there every day. He was still there. It was as though he didn't care now if she knew he was there or not. That actually said a lot to her. In North Korea, it was said that alliances were as fragile as ice on a hot day. She left her apartment and got into her car. It was 10 years old, but still serviceable. And it was hers, until they took it away. Which they could at any time. And depending on how the next mission turned out, that time might be soon coming. She drove out to Pyongyang. She checked her rearview mirror and was not surprised to see a black sedan following her. She drove slowly, well under the speed limit. She was in no hurry. She had no intention of losing whoever was back there. Her trip would take her roughly 70 miles northeast of the capital into a mountainous part of South Hamgyong Province, bisected by the Ipsok River Valley. The official name of where she was heading was Kwanli So No. 15, but most people simply called it Yodok. It was a labor camp or concentration camp or penal colony. Cheung Cha did not care which term was used. It all amounted to the same thing. People taking away the freedom of other people. For years, she had had another name for it. Home. Like other labor camps, Yodok was comprised of two parts, the total control zone from which prisoners were never released, and the revolutionary zone, where prisoners were punished, re-educated, and eventually released. The camp was about 150 square miles in size and had about 50,000 prisoners. Electric fences and over 1,000 guards made sure that no one left of their own volition. Cheung Cha did not believe there was corruption at Yodok. The guards there seemed to do their duty with barbaric joy. At least they had when she was there. And she was still the only prisoner from the total control zone ever voluntarily released. But that release had come with a heavy price, perhaps heavier than if she had tried to escape. That was why she was here today, to relive this part of her life. Well, that was only partly true. It took special permission to do this, which she had requested and received. Those granting that permission understood her to be coming here to pay homage to those who had allowed her freedom in exchange for her lifelong commitment to serve her country. At least, that had been the original intent. Then she had convinced those more powerful than her that there should be another reason, and that she was the ideal person to implement this plan. She had no guarantee that permission would be granted, but it had been. The necessary papers documenting this rode in her inner pocket. The august signatures on the papers would brook no opposition. She parked near the gate and was met there by two guards and the administrator. Cheung Cha knew this man well. He had been the administrator when she was a prisoner here. He bowed to her with respect, and she returned the bow. Her gaze never left his face as they each straightened. In his burnt, wrinkled countenance, she saw the one man she had dreamt of killing for most of her life. She knew that he knew this. But now he was powerless to harm her anymore. Yet there was the way his lip curled back, exposing one misshapen tooth that made Cheung Cha understand quite clearly that he would dearly love to have her back here and in his power.
"It is an honor to have you here, Comrade Yi," he said.
"The Supreme Leader sends his best wishes to you, Comrade Do,"
replied Cheung Cha, making the point of exactly where she was at this stage in her life. Do blinked rapidly behind his thick glasses, and his smile was as false as his next words.
"It does my heart good to see how far you have risen, Comrade Yi."
He escorted her through the gate and into the prison compound. Although Cheung Cha had been gone from this place for many years now, much of it had not changed at all. The huts where the prisoners lived were still made of mud with straw roofs. As she peered inside one, she saw the boards with the blankets on them representing a prisoner's bed. There were 40 of them in a room that was only about 500 square feet in size. The huts were not heated and they were not clean. Thus, disease was rampant. She had heard the administrator say once when she was here that such widespread fatal epidemics saved them from the price of bullets. She stopped in front of one hut. She did so for a particular reason. This had been her hut, where she had lived for years. She glanced over at Do and saw that he too remembered this.
"You have indeed risen far," he said,
his fake smile broadening across his tanned features. He was a pure blood, she knew, a member of the very elite core group. His grandfather had been one of Kim Il-sung's earliest and most ardent supporters. For that, he and his family had been forever rewarded greatly. For the grandson, it meant he got to play God with the lives of hundreds of thousands of his fellow citizens over the years, determining who got to live, and far more often, who died.
"I am still the only one,"
she said back. "Still," he conceded snidely, "it must have seemed a miracle for you."
"For you too."
He bowed again. She waited for him to straighten before adding,
"The Supreme Leader believes that this is a shame. He wants to know why more are not capable of being converted."
This had been the other reward that Chung Cha had requested and had been given for her part in exposing the treachery of General Pak. The power to come here and make these sorts of inquiries. And she had been granted something else. She looked expectantly at Do, who had obviously not been anticipating this. She saw a vein in his temple begin to throb, and his hand shook as he raised it to his face to adjust his glasses. "The Supreme Leader believes?" he said, his voice shaking. The guards with him took a few steps backward, as though to distance themselves from whatever repercussions might befall the man. Chung Cha reached into her pocket and produced the authorizing documents. Do took them, adjusted his glasses again, and read through them before meekly handing them back. "I understand. The Supreme Leader is wise beyond his years. It is an honor to do his bidding."
"I am sure, but let us get down to it. I was in the total control zone. I was not core or wavering. I was in the hostile class, Comrade Do, and now I am acknowledged as one of the most valuable assets we have. Perhaps there are other such assets here, but going to waste. The Supreme Leader does not like waste."
"No, no, of course not. What would you have me do, Comrade Yi? Please. You have but to name it, and it shall be done." Chung Cha looked the man over. He was far smaller and weaker looking than she remembered. To a little girl whose very life or death depended on the daily mood of this person and his underlings, he might as well have been a giant. Now, though, he was nothing to her.
"I want to look over some of the hostels, the girls in particular."
"Girls?" he repeated in a bewildered tone that matched his expression.
"Yes. The Supreme Leader understands quite clearly how useful females can be in certain areas of service, much more so than males, who are more easily identified and targeted as potential enemies of other countries. Do you understand?"
He nodded quickly. "Yes, yes, of course. I can see that." Chung Cha added,
"And I want you to show me some of the more interesting prospects."
He nodded again. "Yes, yes. I will take you myself."
"I am sure you will,"
she said without smiling. He did not seem to grasp the significance of what she said. He was a cruel, cagey, and evil man, that she knew. But he was also petty, vain, and shallow. And such a person could never attain brilliance or even acuity, no matter how hard he tried.
"And I will be sure to communicate your excellent level of cooperation."
"Oh, thank you, Comrade Yi. Thank you. You have no idea what that means to me."
"On the contrary, I have every idea."
He looked a bit put off by this statement, but regained his composure and said, "By interesting, you mean..."
"By that, Comrade, I mean someone like me."
Chapter 50. She had examined over 100 children aged 4 to 14. They all looked alike in many respects, malnourished, filthy, and blank-eyed. She spoke a few words to all of them. Their answers, when they came, were halting, inelegant, and simple. None of this was their fault, she knew. She turned to the guard accompanying her.
"How many were born here?"
He looked at her with some insolence, but had no doubt been told to cooperate fully or feel the Supreme Leader's wrath. He gazed over the ranks of young prisoners with a lazy eye. They might as well have been chickens lined up for slaughter. About half, he answered in a casual tone, and then rubbed a smudge of dirt off his gun. There were more, but they were unauthorized births. So they were, of course, killed along with their mothers. Sheng Cha knew that the children's education, what there was of it, was totally inadequate. They had been raised as simpletons, and they would perish as simpletons, despite whatever belly fire they might have for something more in life. At some point, no matter the rage that dwelled within, beatings and starvation and the brainwashings that were all prevalent, hair would douse all hope until there was nothing left inside. She felt if she had stayed one more day in Yodok, she never would have left it alive. In the distance, Cheng Cha saw a group of children laboring along under the weight of either logs or buckets she knew were filled with dung. One child stumbled and fell, dislodging the contents of her bucket. The guard accompanying the group hit her with both a stick and then the butt of his rifle, and then encouraged the other children to attack her, which they did. They had been taught that when one worker failed, they would all be punished, directing their anger away from the guards, where it rightfully should be, onto one of their own. Cheng Cha watched the beating until it stopped. She made no move to halt the attack herself. Even with the authority of the Supreme Leader riding in her pocket, she could never do such a thing and hope to avoid punishment. The rules of the camps were inviolate, and certainly no one like her could intervene and break them without consequences. But she had no desire to stop the beating. She wanted to see the result of it, because even from this distance she had noticed something that intrigued her. The beaten child rose, wiped the blood off her face, grabbed the bucket off the ground, scooped the dung into the bucket with her bare hands, and marched past the guard and the other children who had beaten her. Her head was held high, and her gaze was fixed determinedly ahead.
"Who is that prisoner?"
Cheng Cha asked the guard. He squinted in the distance and then blanched. "Her name is Min."
"How old is she?"
The guard shrugged. "Maybe 10, maybe younger. She is trouble."
"Why?"
He turned and grinned at her. "She is a tough little bitch. She gets beaten and then gets up and walks off like she won a great victory. She is stupid."
"You will bring her to me."
The guard's grin faded, and he glanced at his watch. "She still has 6 hours of work to perform."
"You will bring her to me,"
said Cheng Cha again, more firmly, her gaze never leaving the man's face. "We heard about you here, what you did at Bukchang." The guard said this in a surly manner, but Cheng Cha, who could sense fear from almost anyone, could see that the man was afraid of her.
"About my killing the corrupt men? Yes, I did. I killed them all. The Supreme Leader was most grateful. He gave me an electric rice cooker in reward."
The guard gazed at her in astonishment, as though she had just informed him that a mountain of gold had been delivered to her door. "Is that why you are here?" he asked. "They suspect corruption?"
"Is there corruption here?"
asked Cheng Cha aggressively. "No, no, none, I promise it."
"A promise is a strong thing, comrade. I will hold you to it. Now bring me Min."
He bowed quickly and hurriedly set off to fetch the child. 20 minutes later, Cheng Cha sat in a small room with 2 chairs and 1 table. She stared over at the little girl. She had asked Min to sit down, but Min had refused, preferring, she said, to stand. And stand she did, with her hands balled into fists as she stared back at Cheng Cha with open defiance. With that look, Cheng Cha knew it was a miracle the girl was even still alive at this place.
"My name is Yi Cheng Cha,"
she said.
"I have been told that your name is Min. What is your other name?"
Min said nothing.
"Do you have family here?"
Min said nothing. Cheng Cha looked over the girl's arms and legs. They were scarred and dirty and heavily bruised. There were open, festering wounds. Everything about the child was an open, festering wound. But in the eyes, yes, In the eyes Chung Cha saw a fire that she did not believe any beatings or disease could extinguish.
I ate rats,
said Chung Cha.
As many as I could. The meat, it staves off the sickness that others here get. It is the protein that does it. I did not know that when I was here. I only learned of it later. I was lucky in that way.
She watched as Min's fists uncurled. Yet Min still looked wary. Chung Cha could understand this. The official first rule of the camp might be, you must not escape. But the unofficial and far more important first rule for any prisoner was, you must trust no one.
I lived in the first hut by the path to the left of the inner gate,
said Chung Cha.
This was some years ago.
You were a hostile then?
Min blurted out.
So why are you no longer here?
She asked, anger and resentment pronounced in each of the words.
Because I was useful to others outside this place.
How?
Demanded Min, now forgetting her caution. In that question, Chung Cha could see what she had hoped to see. The girl wanted out. When so many prisoners, even younger than she, were totally resigned to living here forever. The fire in their lives, and with it their courage, was gone. It was sad, but it was a fact. They were lost.
I was a tough little bitch,
replied Chung Cha.
I am a tough little bitch, too.
I could see that. It's the only reason you're here talking to me.
Min blinked and relaxed a bit more.
How can I be useful to you?
Defiance, yes, but intelligence and its first cousin cleverness, thought Chung Cha. Well, after all, in Korean, that's what Min meant, cleverness and intelligence.
How do you think you can be?
Asked Chung Cha, turning the query around and flinging it back at her. Min pondered this for a few moments. Chung Cha could almost see the mental churnings going on inside the girl's head.
How are you useful to others?
Asked Min.
That allowed you to leave here.
Chung Cha managed to hide her smile and her satisfaction. Min was proving to be up to the challenge.
I was trained to do a specific job.
Then I can too,
said Min.
Even though you don't know what the job is.
I can do anything,
declared Min.
I will do anything to leave here.
And your family?
I have no family.
They're dead?
I have no family,
repeated Min. Chung Cha nodded slowly and rose.
I will be back here in 1 week. You will be ready to go.
Why 1 week?
Chung Cha was surprised by this question.
These things take time. There are arrangements, paperwork.
Ming looked doubtfully at her.
I will be back.
But I may not be alive.
Chung Cha cocked her head.
Why?
They will know what you are going to do.
And?
And they will not let me go.
I come with the highest authority. The guards will not harm you.
There are accidents, and it's not just the guards.
Chung Cha nodded thoughtfully.
The other prisoners.
They do not care about the highest authority. And what do they have to lose?
Their life?
Min screwed up her face.
Why would they care? That would be a good thing for them.
Chung Cha knew that she was absolutely right about this.
Then we will leave here today.
For the first time, probably in her life, Min smiled. Chapter 51 Chung Cha had patiently filled out the paperwork necessary for Min's release to her custody. They had driven back to Pyongyang in the Sungri, with the windows down. Chung Cha did not tell Min that she was doing this because she did not want to smell the girl's stench for the next 70 miles. Instead, she told her it was good to breathe free air. And Min seemed to suck in each breath with delight. She had been reluctant at first to get into the Sungri, Zhang Xia knew immediately why. The girl had never ridden in a car before. She had probably never even seen a car, just the old trucks used at the camp. However, when Zhang Xia had told Min that it was the fastest way to get away from the camp, she had climbed in immediately. After she sat down, her hand reached out and touched all the dials and other items of interest. That was good, thought Zhang Xia. She still had her curiosity, her wonderment. It meant that the child's mind was intact. As they drove away, Zhang Xia looked twice in the rearview mirror at the camp. She had seen prisoners staring at them through the fence, perhaps wondering why they could not also be free. When she looked over at Min, the girl's gaze was pointed straight ahead. She did not look back once. Zhang Xia had done the exact same thing when she had left the camp. She had been afraid that if she looked behind her, they would take her back, or more likely that she would awaken from her dream and return to her nightmare. They had arrived back in Pyongyang very late at night. Zhang Xia had parked her car and led Min up to her apartment. The girl had stared at everything as they had driven along, from asphalt streets to tall buildings, to something as simple as a traffic light, or a neon sign, or a bus, or someone walking along the sidewalk. She looked at it all in complete amazement. It was like she was just now being born, 10 years late. When Min looked up at the apartment building, she wanted to know what this place was.
"It's where I live,"
answered Zhang Xia.
"How many people live with you?" "I live alone." "Well, I did. Now you live with me." "This is allowed?"
asked Min.
"It is allowed everywhere except in the camps,"
Zhang Xia answered. The first order of business had been to prepare Min some food, not too much and not too rich. Not that Zhang Xia possessed any rich food. But even too much white rice could make Min sick. Zhang Xia knew all of this because it was what those who had freed her had done. So the meals would be simple and small to start. The next order of business was a shower, a very long, hot shower with plenty of soap and elbow grease. Zhang Xia did not let Min do this alone, because the girl did not know how to properly clean herself. So Zhang Xia had scrubbed her down. The filth that poured from her skin, hair, and orifices would have made most people sick. It did not faze Zhang Xia. She had been expecting it. And Min exhibited no shame as she watched the dirty water going down the drain. She knew no better. She just wanted to know where the water went.
"Into the river,"
answered Zhang Xia, because that response she knew would suffice for now. It would take many more cleanings for the girl to be truly free from her years of filth. She laid out sheets and a pillow on the small sofa, which would be where Min would sleep for now. Zhang Xia had already purchased clothes and shoes for her, correctly assuming that a camp girl would be smallish. They fit very well, far better than the rags she had come here in. Those went into the trash. Zhang Xia showed Min how to brush her teeth, cautioning her against swallowing the paste. Then she cleaned her nails, which were caked with years' worth of grime and crud. Next, she combed out Min's long hair, untangling knots and trimming errant strands with scissors. Min sat patiently while this was done, staring the whole time in the mirror Zhang Xia had seated her in front of in the small bathroom. She well knew why the girl was studying herself so closely. She had never been in front of a mirror before. Thus she had no idea what she looked like. Zhang Xia could remember herself slipping out of bed at night and going to the bathroom, not because she had to relieve herself, but because she wanted to see what she looked like again. She fed Min another small meal and then attended to her multiple cuts and scabs with peroxide, salve, and bandages. Then she put Min in her makeshift bed under her clean sheets and wearing a new pair of shorts and a top. Even though she had tended to the girl's many injuries, healing cuts and scabbed over old wounds as best she could, Zhang Xia had scheduled a visit to a doctor the next day. She wanted all of these seen to, Infections were rife in the camps and had killed many prisoners. She had not freed men to watch her die. And ordinarily, before prisoners were released from the camps, they had to show that they were free from infection or disease. Since this was nearly impossible, they almost never achieved their liberty. Cheng Cha had thus pledged in her signed paperwork to have a doctor thoroughly examine and treat men within one day of leaving the camp. After settling Min on the sofa, Cheng Cha turned the light off. She heard Min gasp and then say,
"Can you make it light again, Cheng Cha?"
She turned the light switch back on, and then went back over to Min, perching on the edge of the sofa.
"Does the darkness cause you fear?"
She knew that the prison huts had no electricity, and that while Min had probably seen electric lights, she was not accustomed to them. Min said,
"I am not afraid. Then why do you want the lights on?" "So I can see where I live now."
Cheng Cha left the light on and went into her bedroom. She kept the door partly open and told Min if she needed anything to come wake her. Cheng Cha got into bed, but did not go to sleep. Not much scared her anymore. It simply wasn't possible after all she had experienced. But what she had just done frightened her more than beatings or fear of death possibly could. Her whole life had been spent alone, and now she had assumed responsibility for another human being. She listened to Min's even breathing, which because of the tiny size of the apartment was happening only a few feet away. She wondered if the girl was sleeping, or was simply gazing around at a world that she could not believe even existed, and for her, had not existed until a few hours ago. Cheng Cha knew exactly how she felt. She had gone through the same emotional spectrum. But her release and what happened to her afterward were far different from Min's situation. The guards had come for her one morning. At first she thought they were coming to punish her because of a snitch. But that was not the reason. She had met with the prison administrator, Do, the same man she saw today. They had an offer for her. It came from high up in the government. She had no idea what had been the catalyst for it. Would she like to be free? That's what they had asked her. At first she did not understand what they meant. She instinctively thought it was a trick of some kind and was unable to answer, fearing she would say something that would lead to even more pain or perhaps her death. But she was led into another room where there was a group of men and, startlingly enough, a woman who was not a prisoner. Cheng Cha had never seen a woman who was not a prisoner. The woman told Cheng Cha she was with the government and that the leadership was looking for offspring of wrongdoers who wanted to serve their country. They would have to prove their loyalty first, she said, and if they did that, they would be taken to another place, fed, clothed, and educated. They would then be trained over years to serve North Korea. Would Cheng Cha want that? The woman had asked. Cheng Cha could still remember gazing around at the men in the room staring at her. They had on uniforms, not of the prison, but of something else. They had shiny things on their chests, all sorts of colors. She had been dumbstruck, paralyzed, unable to answer. One of the men, who had more shiny things than anyone else, finally said, "Get us another and take this bitch back to where she came from. And however hard you are working her, triple it. And cut her food, too. She has wasted our time." Hands had reached for Cheng Cha, but then she suddenly found her voice.
"What do I have to do?"
she screamed out so loudly that one of the guards reached for his weapon, perhaps afraid she was going berserk and would attack them. A moment of silence passed as all in the room looked at her. The man who had called her a bitch was scrutinizing her in a different way now. He said, "You have been described as a tough little bitch. How tough are you?" He backhanded her across the face, knocking her to the floor. Cheng Cha, all of 10 years old, quickly got back on her feet and wiped the blood away from her mouth. "That is nothing," said the man. "Do not think that makes you tough, because it does not." Cheng Cha gathered her courage and stared back at him.
Tell me what it is I have to do to be free of this place, and I will do it.
The general looked back at her with amusement, and then his features went cold. I do not discuss things with filth. Others will tell you. If you fail, you will never leave this place. I will instruct them to keep you just barely alive, so that you will have many more decades here. Do you understand? Chung Cha kept staring at the man, her mind as clear as it had ever been. It was as though a life of darkness had just been suddenly filled with light. She knew this was the only chance she would ever have to leave here, and she meant to seize it.
If you will not discuss it with filth like me, then who here will tell me what I have to do to be free of this place?
She said firmly. The man seemed surprised by her audacity. He turned to the woman and said, "She will." Then he turned and left. And that was the first and last time that Chung Cha had personally laid eyes on General Pak. Chung Cha was stirred from her musings by her door slowly swinging open. Min stood in the doorway. Chung Cha sat up in her bed and looked at her. The two females did not say anything. Chung Cha motioned with her hand, and Min hurried over and climbed into bed with her. She lay back and immediately went to sleep. But Chung Cha did not go to sleep. She just lay there looking at Min and thinking about events from what seemed like another life. But it truly had once been hers. Chapter 52. "She's back home and safe," Roby pointed out. He and Real were sitting outside at a cafe in D.C., having an early breakfast.
"By a miracle, Roby."
"Miracles happen by chance. This didn't." She put her coffee down and stared at him.
"You know what I meant. You know how many things could have gone wrong. Any one of them could have cratered the mission, and Julie would be dead."
"But she's not dead." Real put her shades on, sat back, and stared off. "And Earl?" he said. She smiled, grimly.
"Back on death row and talking to himself. They don't expect him to last a week."
Ruby's phone buzzed. He looked at it and then sat up straighter. "Blue man."
"At least it's not Evan Tucker. I couldn't take him, not today."
"He wants us to come in."
"Something up, you think?"
"He doesn't usually call a chit-chat." Real rose and threw her cup of coffee into a trash can.
"Then let's not keep the man waiting."
"Rumblings," said Blue Man, "but distinct ones." They were seated in Blue Man's office at Langley. The skies had darkened on the ride over, and rain was starting to fall. Real and Roby glanced at each other. Real said,
"Distinct how?"
"We have numerous contacts in South Korea, China, and Taiwan. These contacts, in turn, have a smaller number of resources planted in North Korea, mostly in Pyongyang. And adding them all up, what do these rumblings say?" asked Roby. "That the North Koreans are planning something."
"Retaliation, you mean?"
"I doubt it's anything else," said Blue Man. "The North Koreans are not known for either their tact or their compassion." "But they can keep secrets," Roby pointed out. "Do you have any clue what form this retaliation might take?" "It seems clear that they have discovered the level of Pak's actions. And now his family has disappeared."
"I didn't think he had any family."
"So they've either been killed or sent to the labor camps," said Roby, with a resigned sigh. Blue Man nodded. "Appears to be the case."